Item four, consider and take possible action on actuarial funding policy as recommended by Siegel Consulting. Paul, John, welcome, as always.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the board. I'm Paul Angel with the Siegel Company, joined with my colleague, John Monroe. And we are revisiting the actuarial funding policy. We first had a detailed discussion with the board on this actually last year. And then at our last meeting with you this year, we went through it in some detail. What you have, excuse me, in your board packet are four items. There's a February 18th letter, which is just a one-page cover letter. Then there is an attachment one, which we'll get to after the slides, attachment one, which goes through and describes in pretty specific detail all the things that have changed, that are proposed to be changed in the draft funding policy that's attached. Attachment two is that draft funding policy. It has tracked the changes that are described in attachment one. And then attachment three is a copy of the long and detailed letter that we did on funding policy for you at the beginning of this project. It's dated March of 2013. And finally, attachment four is the slides that we'll be going through here today. So it's a short slide deck where it really just does a brief overview of what we discussed in great detail the last time we were with you. It then has a little one-page summary of the things that are being proposed and recommended as changes. Then I'll jump to attachment two after the letter, which has a little more detail on those proposed changes, and that'll conclude our prepared remarks. So if we get the clicker up here, as we have discussed, your funding policy has three components: a cost method, which allocates the cost to different years of active member service; asset smoothing, which deals with extraordinary asset volatility before it makes its way into the unfunded liability; and then the unfunded liability amortization policy. How much of your unfunded do you want the employers to pay in the current year? What's the length of those payments and the structure of those payments? We always like to mention there are some other policy considerations which we've included in your detailed statement of policy, so people can see things like the lag between when the contributions are determined and when they actually are put into effect, those sort of things. And then finally, interest crediting and excess earnings policy. While that's an important part of your actuarial function as a 37 Act system, it is not addressed in this policy. That actually is a separate policy, and that's always up for review anytime the board wishes to take a fresh look at that policy. Here's a quick little picture to show you how the different elements of the funding policy fit together. If this whole pie is the present value of future benefits, the amount you would need to fund all future benefits that you ever expect to pay to your current members, including future service and future salary increases for the active members. The cost method splits it between the future costs and what you can think of as the past cost, which is the accrued liability. That's the blue and the green together are the accrued liability. And the asset smoothing method says instead of using market value, which is too volatile to give you a stable contribution pattern, we use a smooth value. And then when you compare that smooth value of assets to the actual accrued liability, again, which is green and blue, the part that's not covered by assets is the unfunded liability, and you have to figure out how much of that to pay this year. So the cost method tells you the normal cost to pay in the year, and then the all the other components, the cost method and the smoothing method and the amortization policy, measure the unfunded and tell you how much of that to pay in the current year. So your current policy is to use the entry age method. It used to be called the entry age normal method, and the emerging terminology is to drop the word normal, to call it the entry age method. By far the gold standard method. Your asset smoothing method, again, is very much the industry standard five-year smoothing with no market value corridor. That is, if you have a bad year like 2008-9, that smooth value can get pretty far away from the market value. But because you're recognizing those changes in 5 years, 5 years is considered sufficiently short. That's a technical term under the standards of practice. You're allowed to do that. So, in effect, you're saying to your employers, if you guys can absorb a loss as big as the 2008 loss in your case, if you can absorb that in 5 years, we'll let you basically get there in a straight line. And that means you don't need one of these constraining corridors. Finally, your unfunded amortization policy, which is really our topic really for action today. When were the discussions, John? I think the discussions were actually in 2008. In 2008, you did a detailed review of this, consistent with emerging model guidelines, in particular that came from a group called a California Actuarial Advisory Panel. And what you adopted was a layered amortization, a layered structure where each year's change in unfunded is separately identified and amortized over a fixed period, and that fixed period is 18 years. That's what you adopted. You also use level percent of pay amortization, which is by far the most common approach for public sector plans. So, what are we recommending? No change to the cost method, no change to the asset smoothing method. That was easy. And then the emerging model practice for unfunded liability. What you have, your 18 years, is just right for the more common changes in unfunded liability that happen routinely. Every year there are gains and losses. You amortize those over 18 years, no recommended change. Every 3 years, we review your assumptions. You adopt a new set of assumptions. That changes your unfunded liability. You amortize that over 18 years, no recommended change. It's the more unusual things like plan amendments and surplus, where the 18-year period we think needs to be revisited. And it's interesting that for plan amendments, we're recommending that you go shorter than 18 years. Whereas for surplus, when we ever have surplus again, we're recommending that you go longer than the 18-year period. So that gets us to our sort of super summary here. Actual gains and losses, currently 18, recommended 18. Assumption or method changes, currently 18, recommended 18. For plan amendments, it's currently 18. We are recommending 15 or less. And the argument here is the 18 is a balance between getting it paid for, what we call demographic matching, and volatility management. That's trying to control the pattern of volatility in those employer contribution rates. But for plan amendments, volatility is not an issue. The volatility is what happens when things outside your control cause the employer's cost to change. Well, that doesn't really apply here. So you end up only with the demographic matching part. And so that's where we're recommending 15 or less. And then there's a particular kind of plan amendment called an early retirement incentive. We're distinguishing here between those and the golden handshakes. We haven't really seen, I don't think, a classic early retirement incentive here in Contra Costa County, but if you ever did, the practice is to do that. It's been a while.
About 5 or 6 years.
Okay. Now, we got to be real careful that what happened 5 or 6 years ago was not, in fact, a golden handshake, which is sort of a special category.
Oh, you're right. It may not have been an early retirement. It was, if you'll tell us you're retiring in the next year, we'll put a whole bunch more money in your retirement for department heads.
No, it was a 2%.
2% key 2%. Employee provision.
I think it's that what John Cullen put in place for department heads to get them to retire.
That was the 2%. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But that was a pay item rather than an ERIP.
Okay. So it was a pay item. Yeah. There was no change to the retirement system to do that. That was just, we'll give you some money. But they did that outside of the retirement system, which means it would not be involved in this decision.
Yeah. But and I appreciate that distinction because the public doesn't look at it that
exactly,
way.
Exactly. Yeah.
John, Paul.
Sir.
Probably over 10 years ago, there was, I think it was in social services or maybe health services, there was an offer basically of an additional couple of years of service.
I don't remember that.
A couple of years of service. You had to be a certain age, and I'm not sure how many people took advantage of it. It was very to a very specific group, which that would have been the golden handshake.
I think that's more like the golden handshake. The early retirement window is, L.A. City did one a couple years ago where, if you retire within a certain window, we will basically add a couple years of service and maybe also add a couple years of age. And so it's not as sort of narrowly defined as the 37 Act Golden Handshake, which is simply it's as though the member bought a couple extra years of service, but the employer paid for it. Yeah, and usually in order to buy service, it has to be other government service. But this is more sort of the airtime, what used to be called airtime. That is, it's just extra service just for the sake of increasing your benefit. And our real point here is your established practice is if the employer does one of these golden handshakes, they tend to be, as has been observed here, fairly narrowly focused. It's not offered to the entire workforce. It'll either be individuals or a fairly limited group of participants, your practice has been to say, fine, but you need to basically fund that now. There's no amortization. And that is well within the guidance for the early retirement incentives, which really lean toward much shorter amortization. So in the draft policy, we simply reaffirm the current practice of immediate recognition for the golden handshakes. And finally, surplus. Well, here, PEPRA, the Pension Reform Act that was passed in 2012, effective in 2013, has kind of, stepped in and taken over that topic. PEPRA says that if you have surplus, instead of amortizing it to produce an amortization credit, not a charge, because it's a surplus, which then instead of having your contribution rate, normal cost plus an amount to pay off the unfunded, and try to imagine this picture where the green part comes all the way over, covers up the blue, and actually starts to cover up part of the yellow. So what you now would have is your contribution would be the normal cost minus an amortization of that surplus. Well, what we learned is that you really want to spread the surplus out as long as you can. So that's why for the recommended policy, we would normally say that you should amortize surplus over 30 years right there. PEPRA says, first of all, until you get to being 120. Until you get to being 120% surplus, until you have a surplus of one-fifth of your liabilities, you ignore the surplus altogether. You just pay the normal cost. And then if you do have surplus over 20%, there are conditions that attach before you can recognize that we're not even sure can possibly be met. So we'd have to look at those carefully. They're worded in somewhat obscure fashion in the code, but depending on how you read it, I'm not sure that it's possible to do what the statute asks for.
It's not likely that this will ever happen, but what would happen if your assets, in fact, exceeded both your accrued past liability and future liabilities as projected?
Now you mean and future liabilities?
Future.
Okay, back in the late 90s, that was what was called a hyperfunded. Instead of being overfunded, overfunded is where, I really like this graph, is like so helpful. Okay, overfunded is where the assets, this green line here, swinging around here, covers up the entire accrued liability. So if you had a little bit of, if say it went over to about here, then you would have a surplus equal to this here. You got my picture, right?
Yep.
Coming around. And that would be, in surplus, you'd be overfunded. Hyperfunded means that the assets are actually big enough to cover the entire pie. That is, you not only have covered the accrued cost, you actually have enough assets to pay all future costs for all future members. We actually had systems that got to that point. Under the statute, there is no, identified as a special condition in any way. That is, the statute only talks about overfunding in the classic case, and it only talks about being 20% overfunded. I guess if you had a plan that only had like a very small number of actives and a whole lot of retirees, 20% overfunding on a liability basis could well be enough to cover the entire thing. Who knows? It's not the case with this plan. So, no, but that is not addressed in any particular way.
So, Paul, is your slide 6 set of recommendations fully included in the edits, the markup in the draft actuarial funding policy?
They are.
Okay.
And there's actually a little bit more. There's some other things in the markup which are not in this summary, and I'll get to those when we get to the chart, which is attachment 2 in your packet.
Well, I'm prepared to make a motion on the funding policy as marked up with some changes. So if you want to jump to that would be helpful to me.
Okay, so then my only last comment here is we still think that your policy should have built into it the idea that if it's time to amortize something, then you should do it over 30 years. That is, have the long period. And there's one other little wrinkle here. So suppose you get to where you're 121% funded. Okay, the statute's not clear on, do you only amortize the 1% that's above the 120, or do you amortize the entire 21%. We think amortizing the entire 21% would not be a good idea because it's this too big a discontinuity. You'd go from contributing normal costs with no offset to contributing normal costs with an offset based on the entire 21% surplus. So we figure as long as you're holding out the 20%, you should even hold it out if you're amortizing the portion above 20%. That's a refinement that we have included in our recommendation. All of this is intended to be very defensive when it comes to surplus. We simply don't trust surplus. It leads to a condition where the employers think that the plan costs less than the normal cost. And that's just a risky policy. Because there's the risk that resources, you know, employer resources will be diverted to other things. And then when the market corrects itself, which it always does, and suddenly you have an unfunded again, you got to come up with this money. So the other thing which is not mentioned here, I think we mentioned it in the funding policy, that is there are other things you can do with surplus. We do not, I know we have it in our discussion letter. We are not going through that discussion now, but you can take risk off the table by changing your asset allocation. I think if we ever get to a surplus condition, those are the conversations you're going to be having, both with your actuary and with your investment manager. What this does is to give you some time to think. So you don't sort of overreact and start lowering costs based on surplus while you're trying to figure out what to do with it in a longer term. I sometimes describe the 30-year amortization along with this 20% cushion, statutory cushion, is the first line of defense against surplus, and then you would pursue other surplus management techniques, which you would see coming at some distance. I think that's it for the slides. Happy to accept a motion. We do have a little more detailed description of what's in, but I will certainly defer to your process.
Well, I don't want to curtail any discussion, but we went through this in detail last time, and we were already into the markup of the policy, so I'm prepared to address it directly, and then maybe, but I don't want to curtail discussion. If there are additional other questions, fine. If not, okay.
I mean, I have other questions with respect to the policy itself, so I'm perfectly fine if you want to put the proposal on or the
okay. Well, just in the interest of moving it along, I'm going to move that we adopt the recommendations set forth in agenda item 4, packet materials by letter dated February 18th, summarized in attachment 1, and specifically adopting attachment 2 with the following changes from the red line shown. So my motion would accept all changes except, as I'm about to say, on page 1, subparagraph 1 under goals of actuarial funding policy, I would strike the word expected in the second sentence. On page 2.
Let me make sure I find that. Tell me that again. Where's the expression?
So on page 1 of your draft actuarial funding policy under the heading Goals of Actuarial Funding Policy, right. Numbered paragraph 1, second line, omit expected in that sentence.
Meaning section 2? Would it read, or is it
the second one or the first one?
You're talking about leaving the first one.
Second line.
Second.
So it's sufficient to provide for all benefits to be provided by CCCERA.
Read the whole sentence then.
No, I would accept all of the recommended changes. So
let's,
I would
just read the whole sentence out loud with the changes you're recommending.
Okay, fair enough. To have future contributions that, together with current plan assets, are expected to be sufficient to provide for all benefits to be provided by CCCERA. That's how I would have the sentence read.
And could I just understand your logic? I was going to change the second expected to a different word because I think it's okay in my mind to assume that to provide for the fact that they may not be there or they may change. So why are you deleting expected or proposing deleting expected, Scott?
Because we've already qualified plan assets that are expected to be sufficient, and our obligation to me is to provide benefits. We're not expected to provide benefits. Our charge is to provide the benefits. I just thought it was too many expected to be.
Which is probably the reason I changed the second one to anticipated, because okay. I think it is appropriate for this board to decide whether or not they're going to have enough assets to cover anticipated benefits. I mean, there is something to be said for what the benefits will be anticipated in the future.
Well, but our funding policy is supposed to be one that provides for that funding. In other words, we have benefits that we're supposed to provide. That's the expected member benefit, and our funding policy is supposed to get us to that point. So I just thought it was a little bit too much of a hedge. The funding policy is we want plan assets expected to be sufficient to provide for the benefits to members, period. It's not expected to be provided. It's to be provided. I just thought it was a qualification we didn't need to make.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the first change. Happily,
I have one other thought on that line, and I promise there's only a few others.
Well, I don't have a second yet.
On the same item, somehow the word "to have future contributions" seems kind of bizarre to me. To collect them or to receive them or whatever them. I would suggest we consider changing the word "have" to "collect."
In what item?
Yeah, where you
at? Same line. First, the number one. Okay. To collect future contributions that together with or as opposed to have future contributions. I just, yeah.
Does Harvey have any comment on
it? I think he did raise his hand.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Well, I think collect is fine on there. I was going to say, I don't think you're disagreeing on the expected business because, Jerry, I think what you're talking about is, let's take COLA, for example. Mm-hmm. We expect that COLA will increase, you know, on average 3% into the future. There may be changes that we don't presently expect that we're not funding for. We're not changing funding, for example, on the anticipation that post-PEPRA, the county may elect a 2% COLA and change for new members. We're not working that in. So we're only working in funding for what we expect, the assumptions that we're making now going forward. So yeah. I think you're both talking about the same mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah, but you're incorrect.
Here, whether or not you leave that expected in or not.
Well, yeah, I think that we were probably thinking that the expected comes in two places. First of all, when you're projecting out the benefit stream, right, there are a lot of assumptions, not just COLA, but how long people live. And so we're always talking about expected benefits. And then we want the contributions to be expected, that is assuming that your investment return happens like it's supposed to match. But I would also agree that I think one expected will get the job done. So I don't think that we would have any objection to dropping the second of the expecteds. Because in effect, the expected covers the entire calculation.
Yeah, so to me, it's a policy. Yeah. It's not a prescriptive. Standard.
Yeah. And then on the to have, for one thing, the reason we did that is because we wanted this is my mother, the grade school grammar teacher. We wanted parallelism to match. All the other ones start an infinitive. Yes. So we wanted to have an infinitive, whether it's to collect or to determine. You know, but I think that we were just trying to get some kind of a verb in there. But to have future contributions, blah 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 blah. I think you would say that to get it. Yeah, I think that would work. That would work.
All right,
but as far as having the one expected, I think that's fine with us.
That's fine. So I'll include collect in the motion. So it's to collect future contributions and still dropping the second expected. On page two.
Before you go on, can I just throw one other idea out there on this? On the first expected, maybe change that to estimated, because we're estimating what the. No.
We would really prefer the word expected. I mean, we talk about expected values. I mean, sure, these are all estimates, but it's a semantic distinction. But just the way you normally describe. What is this number that you're starting with? It's called an expected value. So that's a little bit of technical ease, I guess. I admit that's sort of an actual aesthetic sneaking into this. So, yeah.
Okay with that?
Okay.
All right, so that suggested change remains as to collect and drops the second expected. Page two, under Roman numeral two, asset smoothing method, I would accept your change as, except for the following change. I would strike future ad hoc before adjustments in the second line of the second paragraph.
The entire section or just the word future?
The words future ad hoc. I would strike future ad hoc in the second line of the second sentence.
Because I was suggesting just strike the future.
And I would strike the word necessary in line four of the same paragraph. So the revised version would read, this policy anticipates that future circumstances may warrant adjustments to change the pattern of the recognition of the net deferred investment gains or losses after a period of significant market change, followed by a period of market correction upon receiving analysis from Cicera's actuary. and I would insert where I struck necessary, the necessary, I would insert any required. So it would read, upon receiving any required analysis from Sacera's actuary. The rest of it I would leave unchanged.
Let me work on that second one with you. I don't believe that you want to have your policy say that there's even a chance that you would do this without receiving an analysis. So I think the necessity of the analysis is should be part of your policy. So I would, maybe it could simply say upon receiving an analysis.
Well, but I don't want to concede that in every case, in every adjustment, that analysis might be required. So if it's a required analysis, our fiduciary counsel sitting here is going to tell us, in order to do that, there's a required analysis. If not, then we wouldn't.
I think the nature of this particular adjustment is so well defined in advance. This is not, you know, it's not going to be one time it's going to be this thing, and it's going to be something. It's always going to be exactly the same thing that you already did. We are not opening the door here to anything except a very particularly understood type of adjustment, which is described here. And that, number one, I think it will be your actuary's responsibility to identify when these situations occur and bring them to you in the form of that analysis. So I think that less wiggle room here would be appropriate. So this is not really an open door to anything other than a very particular and very predictable type of adjustment. So I'd like to keep it narrower.
Would you agree that the question of whether an actuarial analysis is required in any given case would be within the purview of the fiduciary counsel's obligation to tell us?
I'm not sure it's in their expertise.
If it helps, Scott, I can't imagine any situation arising that I would not, in this circumstance, recommend an actuarial analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the board is qualified to do this on its own without the assistance of an actuary. That would be prudent for the board.
Well, as you'll see from the next year, I hear you. So I'm fine with getting rid of my idea to put in any required, and I guess my thought is to strike the necessary. What I want to do is I want to avoid words like necessary or appropriate, because those are lawyer words that create a field of dreams for arguing about what is appropriate or what is necessary. It seems to me if we need to receive an analysis from our actuary, because you're telling me in every case I would, and Harvey's telling me you can't imagine a case where I wouldn't, then that ought to be sufficient, right?
So I would just maybe
the necessary analysis. It's in the analysis.
Just say an analysis.
An analysis.
An analysis.
Yeah, there you go. That's
fine. So that would be my motion. Would include, as I've already indicated, striking future ad hoc in the second line, and striking the necessary and inserting an analysis. On page 3.
Just a couple more thoughts, not to be the dead horse on that, but I'm still troubled by taking out ad hoc adjustments. So the policy, as you're suggesting, would read, the policy anticipates that future circumstances may warrant
adjustments.
Well,
we don't need two futures.
Okay, but you're suggesting taking out the word ad hoc adjustments.
I'm just not sure. You know, ad hoc to me is a term of art, and I don't know if it actually applies in this instance that any of those adjustments might be ad hoc.
I'm sorry, perhaps I misunderstood, but I thought you said take out the words future ad hoc adjustments.
No, just future ad hoc. Future ad hoc.
You need adjustments, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Then one last thought just for same paragraph, just for agreement. The third line down there that begins the word adjustment, I believe, should be plural because it's been plural in earlier references in the same paragraph.
Agreed. I'll include that in my motion.
Such adjustments would be appropriate.
Adjustments, plural, in line 5. All right, top of page 3. I would accept all of these changes in the, I guess, the little arrowed bullet, Paul, it starts off in less.
Mm-hmm.
In the second line, I would strike appropriate. So it would read, after receiving an actuarial analysis, without describing what type or kind or manner it is.
Yep, yep. Okay. Harvey and I are doing like sort of an instant rating system over here. Okay.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, no, but Harvey's kind of the East German judge.
And that is my motion.
Before, so I have another comment on that.
Am I going to get
How
on the podium,
like
Harvey?
That?
No.
Homer.
I'll second the motion so that we can have discussion.
Okay. Marilyn would like to go back as to, are we done with this? Deborah, did you have a comment on this particular section?
I actually have a recommendation. In the last conversations we had about this, I had notes that we had talked quite a bit about making 15 years 10 years. I am in favor of changing.
Where are you?
A.
Where are you?
Bullet point A on the top of page 3.
Okay.
This is for plan amendments?
Yes, this would be the amortization period for plan amendments. I would prefer to see us use 10 years on plan amendments as opposed to 15. We're going from 18 to 15 in this policy. I would prefer to see us go to 10. I believe plan amendments should be paid for in a more rapid at a more rapid pace. And then, as well, in bullet point B, I would really prefer to see us match that with the other one and change up to 5 years to immediate, so that any temporary retirement incentives are treated the same way as golden handshakes with an immediate and no 5-year amortization.
So. Interesting. Mr. Chairman.
What does the word temporary mean when you say temporary retirement? Oh, it's a short term.
Yeah, you have to elect it within a window, generally.
I see. Okay.
Those are the generically the ERIPs in your summary?
Correct. Correct. Okay. So I believe the proposal would be to treat all ERIPs the way that the document is drafted would treat golden handshakes.
Correct.
Right. A quick comment on the 10 years. In the last week, there have been three pieces of guidance on funding policy issued by the three national actuarial organizations. So it's a hot topic. Society of Actuaries came out and said 10 to 15 years. They did not get into this level of detail. And then the Academy of Actuaries really just did policy guidelines, has not yet done any details. But the Conference of Consulting Actuaries did a very detailed document similar to the CAP document. It took the CAP document, which is the California Actuary Advisory Panel, and sort of tighten it up a little bit. And what it says for plan amendments, it distinguishes between active plan amendments and retired plan amendments. And I'm presenting this just for information. And what it says is, you know, for retired plan amendments, like if you put in an ad hoc COLA, or if you put in, for systems that do not have an automatic COLA, that put in a COLA, because this is a national standard, really you want to go shorter than 15. You want to try to go closer to the life expectancy of the members, and you also want to make sure that you don't have negative cash flow. You don't want the amortization payments in that first year to be less than the actual cash you're paying out that year. You know, and this could happen if you have a benefit increase that's a fairly short duration. So just so you know, the idea at least of taking the 15 and splitting it between 15 for actives, 15 or shorter for actives, and 10 or shorter for retireds, that's out there in the literature. So this would be consistent with that idea, but it would say, you know, let's just use 10 for all plan amendments. So, you know, there's some guidance out there that does exactly what you just described, but it happened to do it only for retired amendments. So just as a point of information.
Can we piggyback your recommendations onto Scott's?
Well, so would you like me to propose an amendment to the amendment on the table?
Well, I don't think we have to get so technical. There's a motion and a second, but if you want to add to it so that, I mean, do you?
I'll accept those amendments.
And I'll accept it as a seconder.
Well, so again, what are the amendments that is proposed in your head? You state those?
My proposed change would be on bullet point A at the top of page 3 that we replace the number 15 with 10, and in bullet point B, we would replace the term of up to five years with immediately.
We'll be funded immediately.
Period, right.
We would be replacing over a period of up to 5 years with the word immediately.
Right.
The way I like the, well, on the first recommendation you have, could we not say 15 years or less as opposed to fixing it to 10 years? Because, again, in the proposal, Paul showed this earlier, it gives us that discretion. We don't have to go up to 15 years, depending on the impact of the amendment. We may want to cut it shorter to 10 years or less. I mean, it gives us a range between 0 and 15. It doesn't say we always have to go up to 15 years. And then on the second recommendation, it's pretty much doing the same thing. It's giving us a range of up to 5 years, not that we have to go to 5th year to amortize the change, but we have that flexibility. Is that what you were proposing before?
Yeah. Well, one reason that I think, well, when we're talking about guidance to all plans at once, we tend to say 15 or less. The issue with having 15 or less in a policy like this is, let's just walk through this operationally, how this would work. So the county and one of the bargaining parties just starts talking about a plan amendment, and they want to get a sense of what the cost is. If this says 15 or less, then they'd have to somehow bring the issue to the board before the study is done. And then the board, based on the type of plan amendment, would have to determine what the amortization period will be for that particular proposal, and then they can go back and do their study. Whereas the way this is drafted deliberately is so that everybody knows what the period is. Now, they can always come in and ask you to change it, but that way, if you want to start calculating some numbers, if the county wants to go off and hire their own actuary, and the actuary says, what amortization period should I use, you can't tell him 15 or less. You got to give him a number. So that's why having a fixed number here gives your parties at interest clear guidance on what the default procedure would be for pricing plan amendments. And the same, what I think, would apply to the early retirement incentive. So it's sort of a well-definedness that I think you want to have here in order to give your parties something they can go work with.
And are you thinking just to keep the unfunded liability more control? Is that your thoughts on that?
No, my thought is that if you're doing a plan amendment, you should pay for it over 10 years or... I think 10 years is the maximum amount you should spread that cost over. That's nothing to do with control.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn?
Yeah, I'd be interested, though, other than flexibility, is there another financial reason why we wouldn't?
No, I'm just remembering from the last discussion we had that it seemed like we wanted to leave some discretion in determining, really, how far we want to amortize out the amendment. Not every change would be equal. There would be times where you may need just only 1 year immediately, where other times you may need a little bit more, depending on the impact of that amortization on the employer.
So it was the flexibility issue as opposed to a fiscal issue.
Yeah, well, that's what I got out of the discussion last time, but maybe I misunderstood. But again, I appreciate your point there. You want to define it narrowly here so that, again, it's a... They can only anticipate so much when they start playing with the numbers.
Yes.
You don't want them to fudge it one way or the other, but that
right.
plays to their advantage.
Yeah. Or if they, you know, we've had this happen. You know, if they do their cost study based on, you say you put in 15 or less, and they do their cost study and they make a deal based on 15, then they bring it to you and you go, well, actually, we decided on this one you ought to use 10. Then they got to start over. You know, so it lets them know sort of what they can, you know, what they should bargain, you know, what they should use to price these things in bargaining, with sort of a nice clear definition up front.
And so the proposal again for 10 years could be too much for some. I mean,
if that's the case, then they won't adopt the plan amendment.
Do you have an example of a plan amendment maybe coming up or kind of give me something to grasp?
No, not really. I mean, we don't see a lot of benefit increases. Well, but this, at the risk of disrupting this entire process.
Oh, don't do that.
I know. The other thing that you will see, if you read this document, it's a discussion draft. Again, when we took a fresh, the conference actuarial committee, when we took a fresh look at the CAP document, CAP talks about plan amendments on a presumption that they are plan amendments that increase benefits. You know, it's possible someday that we might have a plan amendment that decreases benefits for current members. And again, California, right now, the odds are against that because of the legal structure. But if you have a plan amendment that decreases your liability, in effect, that's a whole different case. There, you don't want it to be too short. You don't want to take, if you're paying off your current benefits over 18 years and you reduce benefits, you don't want to take that credit over any shorter than 18 years. You want to match up the credit against what's already being paid off. So I think that there may be some cases out there that this does not address. But again, we're having this in here to try to have it be complete. I don't know that we see a lot of plan amendments really in the pipeline these days. So just so you know, that's another wrinkle that could come
up
someday.
Paul, you recommended 15. Why did you recommend 15, or is 10 okay with you?
10 is definitely okay with us. I think that the original 15 came in there, and again, this was back before we distinguished between actives and retireds. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the science at the time, and so the idea was that 15 is it's closer to the demographic matching argument, but that doesn't mean you couldn't go further, and I think 10 would just bring you further in that direction.
Okay, Marilyn.
I wouldn't want Mr. Tellis to interpret the 15 as being precluding something. Because remember, our original draft says 15 or shorter. Mm-hmm. So if you pick something shorter, I think you're consistent with our recommendation. Okay. That's probably the best way to think of it.
Okay, Marilyn.
I know I'm a short timer, but I have one suggestion. On page 1, number 1, rather than to collect future contributions, this is an actuarial funding policy. I think collect is the next step down the road. I think Paul had a good idea. This should be to determine future contributions.
I would lean in that direction. We have to talk to the maker of the motion.
The maker of the motion. It just makes more sense.
That's fine with me as a second. I'm
trying to make sure I still get onto the podium in Harvey's eyes. I'll accept that, and it sounds like the seconder accepts that.
Go for the bronze, Scott. Go for the bronze.
On the one involving the amortization period for plan amendments, again, just some wordsmithing. As it stands, this will sound a little redundant, but as it stands now, you already have language to describe paying it immediately, so maybe we could use the same. And so it would read, the increase in UAL resulting from a temporary retirement incentive will be funded in full upon adoption of the temporary retirement incentive.
Yes,
that way it reads exactly the same way as the golden handshake language.
That's what we want.
In fact, why don't you just say it once?
I like that even.
Treat it the same.
Part of me likes having it separate, just because those, in a way, those are two different decisions, but it's not a material adjustment. Sometimes it's nice just to actually have it in there twice. Who knows? Some future board may want to change one and not the other. Okay. So that would be my suggestion to this. The second is that we simply use the same
language. Any thoughts on Paul's?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay. I'll accept that recommendation.
Good.
Clean up the language. Seconder thinks that's okay.
So just one other comment. In the last meeting, we had some discussion.
Are we still in the same section?
No.
Oh, we're not.
Did you have comments?
No, but there was a motion. On.
No, but we're putting it all together.
Oh, got it. Okay. All right, very good.
So on the 18-month delay in the rate implementation, we had some discussion.
Where are you?
Where are we?
Page 3 bottom.
Page 3 bottom.
Page 5 bottom,
policy considerations. We had some conversation in that last meeting about bringing this issue back to the board for further conversation about whether we should be doing this 18-month delay, or I believe as to whether there was there should be a cost impact put in. Correct?
Yeah, put an adjustment in.
Right, put an adjustment in. And I'm not sure where we landed with that, if that's coming back for us to address this issue, or are we going to adopt this policy as is?
Well, there is an adjustment, but the adjustment is 18 months delay.
It's made in the next valuation.
Unfunded liability.
Right.
But it's not adjusted in advance.
Right.
True.
The employer's paying it alone.
But this delay is actually the employer's request.
Employee plays, okay. Yeah.
And the way the law is, once we adopt contribution rates, there's supposed to be at least a 60-day period for the employer to be to have time to budget. Right. We don't have that. Our valuation, because we're calendar year, they're fiscal year.
Yeah,
by the time we get our valuation, we can't do it.
And I can appreciate that, but the fact is that cost impact is borne solely by the employer,
correct,
not by the employee as well, or that delay. Once the employer knows that by requesting the 18-month delay, they're going to bear the cost alone,
We had, there was a big discussion with regards to that, and that was the request by the employee in mass of that delay, so to allow them for budgeting purposes.
Oh, there it is, yeah.
So I think the question is that we're adopting a policy here that's a funding policy, and we, you know, either we adopt this as written with no cost impact shared by the employee, it's all going into the unfunded liability, or we address this policy at some future meeting, because I know it's a big topic.
Yeah, I first of all, even if you make an adjustment like a couple of our client systems do, it still is an adjustment only on the employer rate. Mm-hmm. So how factoring that into the member rates, I don't think is going to be consistent with the way the member rates are calculated. I would suggest that is enough of a separate topic that if the board wishes to revisit that aspect of the policy, that I would suggest you adopt this to frame your status quo and then provide direction to the actuary to add that to our project list.
And give the employers time to come back and
sure,
respond.
Sure, the whole thing.
No, I don't want to change it right now.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I was a little surprised that we didn't have in one place a comprehensive funding policy. It's in a number of board actions and policies, and I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying it is what it is. This struck me as a chance to take the status quo with some adjustments, get it finalized in one place, and thereafter, you know, on issue by issue, topic by topic, we can address it. But our funding policy is there. We can go to the shelf and pull it off and say, this is it. So I appreciate all the work that went into this as well, Paul. I know you guys spent a lot of time drafting and redrafting, so that I'd prefer to adopt the policy and take amendments on a discrete basis, personally. Mm-hmm. Gary?
I know it's going back, but we got to the bottom of the page really fast. So, and with a nod to your mother, there's a couple of things in here that are just pretty passive language as opposed to active language, and some wordiness and syntax problems. And other than that, it's fine. Yeah. I'm suggesting the very first paragraph at the top that it says, and I think this is consistent with what...
Which page? Yeah.
Top of page three, we're back. Just it says, unless the board adopts an alternative authorization period after receiving...
Amortization
period after receiving an actuarial analysis. Somehow dropping the board down further makes it a very passive... So I'm just saying, move it up. So unless the board adopts an alternative amortization period after receiving an actuarial analysis. One of the other things I note, and I just, it's maybe a distinction without a difference. This alternating with we will and shall throughout the document always bothers me. You know, it seems like something attorneys could discuss forever as to whether or not shall is stronger than will.
Oh, come on.
And if somebody says no, it's the same thing, then why don't we pick one and use it throughout the document? I mean, we either shall do all these things or we will do all these things. I don't understand the alternating back and forth throughout the document, because it suggests there's a difference. And I think it's a distinction without a difference. So that's just a general thought. You see sometimes in the same paragraph, we will do this, but we shall do that. What's the difference? Okay.
Was this some policy run through you? Explains that the accountants did it.
The accountants did it. One of the other things, is, before we get to the bottom of the page, about middle of the page, the arrow, but the second paragraph, we could take out a whole bunch of words here, because I used to charge my staff $1 per extra word. The first sentence could simply say, if the surplus exceeds, as opposed to if amount of such surplus is in excess of. Good God. There's a lot of extra words there. So if the surplus exceeds 20%. And then I think two more lines down, we can delete the word such after subsequent such surpluses. And just, these are just extra words that somebody's getting paid for, I guess. Then I would suggest one line later, it sounds like this is dependent. So after the words amortization period of 30 years, comma, but only if the other conditions are also deemed to have been met. That's the sense I get out of that. You have to hit all the buttons, all the bases. You can't just do the one.
Say that last one again, Jerry.
So where it says amortization period of 30 years, I would suggest adding a comma after years and then adding the word but only if the other conditions of section 7522.52 are also deemed to have been met or have also been met, whatever.
Any other changes?
Touche.
I just want clarification on the last page six. glossary.
Page six. Oh, I have one other.
Actuarial accrued liability.
Oh, we're still on page three.
Hang on.
Just a minor change. At the bottom of.
Good try.
I think Rusty's double parked. last paragraph, other policy considerations, just to consider change, deleting a word, in order to allow employers. I don't think we have to have the employers. And now we can move right on.
Okay, well, just let me just take that capsule shot. I'm fine with those amendments to be made as part of the motion, except for will and shall. I'd rather. The usual distinction is between shall and may, for the obvious reasons.
Sure.
Will and shall may or may not have a nuanced reason for being there. So I don't want to make that judgment on the fly. I would accept it. That is, I'll accept the text as was written. We can look at wills and shalls in the future. But as to your other changes, I would accept them as part of the.
Yeah, it was just a general comment. That right. Usually, when you read the document, you somebody
if
you
we
assume the author
shall and may,
making a distinction.
I'd have a different answer for you. Shall and will, I'd want to read each one in the context right now. I read this several times.
Yeah.
I was fine with it, so I'm not willing to embrace that, but I'll embrace the other changes.
You can always spot drafts by committee.
Seconder?
I suspect if I were doing this over, I'd probably go with will. I think Mom taught me that shall is first person. It's I shall and he will.
You will.
That's yes. One version of that.
I don't even know your mother, but I think she's a wonderful woman.
She's a wonderful woman. So
I
would have no problem with changing those two shall to will or whatever.
Okay, now rest.
Talk about the issue.
Okay, last one on my part. It's on the last page, or second last page, page six. Just, again, I want you to understand the term positive difference when it's used in both the definition of unfunded liability, or UAL, and surplus.
Where are you, sir?
On page
fourth
six.
Fourth bullet from the bottom?
Yeah, they're both at the bottom, the UAL and the surplus definition. Positive difference, we're using the right.
I know. Okay, it's a math term. I mean, take A minus B,
right.
But you want to make sure that it can't be negative. So that's that you call A minus B but not less than zero is called the positive difference between A and B. That's what that means. I'm sorry.
He's positive.
Yeah, I'm positive. That's what it means. that you're right. That is a sort of a technical math term.
Appreciate
that.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. All right.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. No other changes or suggestions?
Okay, and we're did is someone I got all those changes except for the one at the top of page three. We got that. Okay, all right.
Okay. Any other comments? Motion with those changes in mind. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed. Abstentions.
Cue the national anthem.
Yeah. So I'd now like to go over attachment two in some detail so you can know what you just adopted. No. Okay. Thank you. By the way, congratulations. This is actually, accurately speaking, this is a big day. You have a written funding policy that comprehensively incorporates not just the basic stuff, but all this sort of other things. So any actuary or anybody else that wants to know, you know, if they want to compare what you're doing to what somebody else is doing, or you really have that in one place, and that's just a great improvement in your governance. So I'm gonna commend.
Thank you for all the work.
Did you bring the gold medals or no?
Thanks.
Did you bring the gold medals?
Yeah, did you?
I think they're cookies.
Paul, just one. On the bottom of page five, the red highlight.
Yes.
Change in the last paragraph. The et cetera, necessary or confusing? I'm not sure what it applies to.
Well, I put it in there because we wouldn't separately track the outstanding balance. We wouldn't credit it with the assumed return. We wouldn't do stuff like that. If you want to remove it, I wouldn't lose any sleep. But that's why I put it in there.
But I think it's the whole process of what you need to do to maintain separate costs. And tracking the outstanding balance is one of those. But there are other things, as John just mentioned. I think that's the idea.
I think if you just throw the et cetera in there, it doesn't really reference back to anything specific. I mean, John understands what it applies to, but I'm not sure
anybody else
just reading this document
Well, and I would suggest that instead, if you're going to take it out, you got to put in what et cetera means.
Well, it's talking about the stuff in the second paragraph under additional employer duty and payments. It's talking about that whole paragraph.
But you're okay with taking it out?
I'm okay with taking it out. Yeah.
So moved.
All right.
Good. Just a second. Yep.
It's our first amendment of the policy. We
yeah,
just
nice.
It's
good. I like it.
Can we just make that part of the original motion so that you don't have to do the minutes, like two separate motions?
So that was an amendment to the original motion, if there's no...
No, wait, we already voted on the original
motion. Okay, so an amendment. No. So a motion to make that amendment. Karen, you seconded?
Yes.
Everyone in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. Okay. Okay, now, I don't...